He paused when I didn't reply or react, and looked up to see me staring at the two women. Their faces were stiff with dread. "How about you get Ulla in the shower?" I said to Lisa with a grim little smile. "Have one yourself. I reckon we'll be finished here in a little while." Lisa led Ulla into the bathroom and ran a shower for her. We dumped Maurizio's body onto the plastic sheet and stripped it of its clothes. His skin was pallid, matte, and in some places marbled grey. In life, Maurizio was a tall, well-built man. Dead and naked, he looked thinner, feebler somehow. I should have pitied him. Even if we never pity them at any other time, and in any other way, we should pity the dead when we look at them and touch them. Pity is the one part of love that asks for nothing in return. And because of that, every act of pity is a kind of prayer. And dead men demand prayers. The silent heart, the tumbled nave of the chest unbreathing, and the gutted candles of the eyes, they summon our prayers. Each dead man is a temple in ruins, and when our eyes walk there, we should pity. We should pray. But I didn't pity him. "You got what you deserve," I thought, as we rolled his body in the plastic sheet. I felt despicable and mean-souled for thinking it. But the words wormed their way through my brain, like a murderous whisper working its way through an angry mob. "You got what you deserve." Hassan had brought a laundry-style trolley basket with him. We wheeled it into the room from the corridor. Maurizio's body was beginning to stiffen up, and we were forced to crunch the legs to fit it into the basket. We wheeled and carried it down two flights of stairs, unobserved, and out into the quiet street, where Hassan's delivery van was parked. His men used the van every day to deliver fish, bread, fruit, vegetables, and kerosene to his shops in the African ghetto. We lifted the wheeled basket into the back of the van and covered the plastic-wrapped body with loaves of bread, baskets of vegetables, and trays of fish. "Thanks, Hassan," I said, shaking his hand and passing in the $10,000. He stuffed the money into the front of his jacket.
"No,"
he rumbled, in the basso voice that commanded unquestioning respect in his ghetto.
"I am very happy to do this work. Now, Lin, we are even. All even."
He nodded to Abdullah and left us, walking half a block to his parked car. Rahim leaned out of the van to flash a wide smile at me, before turning over the engine with a flick of his wrist. He drove away without looking back. Hassan's car followed it a few hundred meters behind. We never heard so much as a murmur about Maurizio again. It was rumored that Hassan Obikwa kept a pit in the center of his slum. Some said the pit was full of rats. Some claimed that it was filled with scuttling crabs. Others swore that he kept huge pigs in the pit. Whatever the hungry creatures were, all the whisperers agreed that they were fed from time to time with a dead man, one piece of the corpse at a time.
"Money you did spend well," Abdullah muttered, with a blank expression, as we watched the van drive away.
We returned to the apartment and repaired the door locks so the door could be sealed shut when we all left. Abdullah phoned another contact and arranged for two reliable men to visit the apartment on the following day. Their instructions were to bring a saw, cut the couch into pieces, and remove it in rubbish sacks. They were to clean the carpet and leave the apartment in an orderly state, removing every trace of its recent occupants. He put the phone down and it rang at once. His contact in Dadar had news. Modena had been discovered by staff in the hotel room and rushed to hospital. The contact had visited the hospital and learned that the weak and wounded man had checked himself out of the ward. He was last seen speeding away in a taxi. The doctor who'd attended him doubted that he would survive the night.
It's weird, I said, when Abdullah had related the news. I knew Medina, you know. I sort of knew him well. I saw him at Leopold's, I don't know, 100 times. But I can't remember his voice. I can't remember what he sounded like. I can't hear his voice in my head, if you know what I mean.
I liked him, Abdullah said.
I'm surprised to hear you say that.
Why?
I'm not sure, I replied. He was so meek.
He would have made a good soldier.
I raised my eyebrows in greater surprise. Medina wasn't just meek, it seemed to me then. He was a weak man. I couldn't imagine what Abdullah meant. I didn't know then that good soldiers are defined by what they can endure, not by what they can inflict. And when all the loose ends were cut or tied, when Ulla left the city for Germany, and Lisa moved to a new apartment, and the last questions about Modena and Maurizio and Ulla faltered, faded, and ceased, it was the mysteriously vanished Spaniard who claimed my thoughts most often. I made 2 double-shuffle flights to Delhi and back in the next 2 weeks. I followed that by flying a 72-hour turnaround to Kinshasa with 10 new passports for Abdul Ghani's network. I tried to keep busy, tried to focus on the work, but the screen in my mind was filled too often with an image of him, Modena, tied to the bed and staring at Ulla, watching her leave him there, watching her walk away with the money, and gagged, no way to scream. And what he must have thought when she entered the room, I'm saved. And what he must have thought when he saw the terror in her face. And was there something else in her eyes? Was it revulsion? Or was it more terrible than that? Did she look relieved, perhaps? Did she seem glad to be rid of him? And what did he feel when she turned and walked away and left him there and closed the door behind her? When I was in prison, I fell in love with a woman who was an actress in a popular television program. She came into the prison to teach classes in acting and theatre for our prison drama group. We clicked, as they say. She was a brilliant actress. I was a writer. She was the physical voice and gesture. I saw my words breathe and move in her. We communicated in the shorthand shared by artists everywhere in the world. Rhythm and elation. After a time, she told me that she was in love with me. I believed her. And I still believe that it was true. For months, we fed the affair with morsels of time stolen from the acting classes, and long letters that I smuggled to her through the illegal jail mail system known as the stiff letter run. Then trouble found me, and I was thrown, literally, into the punishment unit. I don't know how the screws found out about our romance, but soon after I arrived in the punishment block, they began to interrogate me about it. They were furious. They saw her affair with a prisoner, carried on for months under their noses, as a humiliating affront to their authority, and perhaps to their manhood. They beat me with boots, fists, and batons, trying to force me to admit that she and I had been lovers. They wanted to use my confession as the basis for laying a charge against her. During one beating, they held up a photograph of her. It was a smiling publicity still that they'd found in the prison drama group. They told me that all I had to do to stop the beatings was nod my head at it. Just nod your head, they said, holding the picture before my bloody face. Just nod your head, that's all you have to do, and it'll all be over. I never admitted anything. I held her love in the vault of my heart, while they tried to reach it through my skin and my bones. Then one day, as I sat in my cell after a beating, trying to stop the blood flowing into my mouth from a chipped bone in my cheek and my broken nose, the trapdoor opened in the door of my cell. A letter fluttered in and landed on the floor. The trapdoor shut. I crawled over to the letter and crawled back to the bed to read it. The letter was from her. It was a Dear John letter. She'd met a man, she said. He was a musician. Her friends had all urged her to break up with me because I was serving a 20-year sentence in prison and there was no future in it for either of us. She loved the new man, and she planned to marry him when his concert tour with the symphony orchestra was complete. She hoped I understood. She was sorry, but the letter was goodbye. Goodbye forever. And she would never see me again. Blood dripped onto the page from my broken face. The screws had read the letter, of course, before giving it to me. They laughed outside my door. They laughed. I listened to them as they tried to make a victory of that laughter. And I wondered if her new man, her musician, would stand up under torture for her. Maybe he would. You can never tell what people have inside them until you start taking it away, one hope at a time. And somehow, in the weeks after Maurizio's death, Modena's face, or my mind's picture of his gagged and bloody and staring face, became confused with my own memories of that love I'd lost in prison. I wasn't sure why. There didn't seem to be any special reason why Modena's fate would twist itself into the strands of my own. But it did, and I felt a darkness growing within me that was too numb for sorrow and too cold for rage. I tried to fight it. I kept myself as busy as I could. I worked in two more Bollywood films, taking small parts, as an extra at a party and in a street scene. I met with Kavita, urging her once again to visit Anand in prison. Most afternoons I trained at weights and boxing and karate with Abdullah. I put in a day here and there at the slum clinic. I helped Prabhakar and Johnny to prepare for their weddings. I listened to Kadarbai's lectures and immersed myself in the books, manuscripts, parchments, and ancient faience carvings in Abdul Ghani's extensive private collection. But no work or weariness could drive the darkness from me. Little by little, the tortured Spaniard's face and silent screaming eyes became my own remembered moment. Blood falling on the page and no sound escaping my howling mouth. They claim a hidden corner of our hearts, all those moments that stay with us unscreamed. That's where loves, like elephants, drag themselves to die. It's the place where pride allows itself to cry. And in those sleep-lonely nights and think-rambled days, Modena's face was always there, staring at the door. And while I worked and worried, Leopold's changed forever. The crowd that had coalesced there dispersed and disappeared. Carla was gone. Ulla was gone. Modena was gone, and probably dead. Maurizio was dead. Once, when I was too busy to stop for a drink, I passed the wide entrance arches, and I saw no face that I knew. Yet Didier persisted at his favourite table each evening, conducting his business and accepting drinks from old friends. Gradually a new crowd collected around him, with a new and different style. Lisa Carter brought Kalpana Iyer with her for drinks one night, and the young assistant producer became a Leopold's regular. Vikram and Letty were in the last stages of preparation for their wedding, and they stopped for a coffee, a snack, or a beer almost every day. Anwar and Dilip, two young journalists who worked with Kavita Singh, accepted her invitation to drop in and look the place over. On their first visit, they found Lisa Carter, Kalpana, Kavita, and Letty, with three German girls who'd worked for Lisa as extras on a film. Seven beautiful, intelligent, vivacious young women. Anwar and Dilip were healthy, happy, unattached young men. They came to Leopold's every day and night after that. The ambience created by the new group was different to that which had flowered around Carla Sorenen. The indelible cleverness and piercing wit that were Carla's gifts had inspired her own group of friends to a more profound discourse and a higher, thinner laughter. The new group took its more erratic tone from Didier, who combined the expressive mordancy of his sarcasm with a proclivity for the vulgar, the obscene, and the scatological. The laughter was louder, and probably more frequent, but there were no phrases that remained with me from the jokes or the jokers. Then one night, a day after Vikram married Letty, and a few weeks after Maurizio went into Hassan Obikwa's pit, as I sat amongst the new group, while the cawing, shrieking gulls of good humour settled on them, sending up squawks of laughter and fluttering hands, I saw Prabhakar through the open arch. He waved to me, and I left the table to join him in his cab parked nearby.
"Hey, Prabhu, what's up? We're celebrating Vikram's wedding. He and Letty got married yesterday."
"Yaslin Baba, sorry for disturbing the newly marriages."
"It's okay. They're not here. They've gone to London to meet her parents. But what's up?"
"Up, Lin Baba."
"Yeah, I mean, what are you doing here? Tomorrow's your big day. I thought you'd be drinking it up with Johnny and the other guys at the Jopad party."
"After this talk only, then I will go," he replied,
fidgeting nervously with the steering wheel. Both front doors of the car were open for the breeze. It was a hot night. The streets were crowded with couples, families, and single young men trying to find a cool wind or a curiosity somewhere to distract them from the heat. The crowd who streamed along the road beside the parked cars began to eddy around Prabhakar's open door, and he pulled it shut hard. "Are you okay?"
"Oh, yes, Lin. I'm very, very fine," he said.
Then he looked at me.
"No, not really, Baba. In fact of speaking, I am very, very bad."
"What is it?"
"Well, how to tell you this thing? Lin Baba, you know I am getting a marriage to Parvati tomorrow. Do you know, Baba, the first time I ever saw her, my Parvati, was before 6 years, when she was 16 years old only. That first time, when she first came to the Jopad party, before her daddy Kumar had his chai shop, she was living in a little hut with her mummy and daddy and sister, the Sita, who is a marriage for Johnny Cigar. And that first day, she carried a mutka of water back from the company well. She carried it on her head."
He paused, watching the aquarium of the swirling street through the windscreen of the cab. His fingernail picked at the rubber leopard skin cover he'd laced onto his steering wheel. I gave him time.
"Anyway," he continued, "I was watching her, and she was trying to carry that heavy mutka and walk on the rough track. And that mutka, it must have been a very old one, and the clay was weak because suddenly it just broke up in pieces. And all the water spilled down on her. She cried and cried so much. I looked at her, and I felt..."
He paused, looking up at the strolling street once more. "Sorry for her?" I offered.
"No, Baba. I felt..."
"Sad? You felt sad for her?"
"No, Baba. I felt an erection in my pants, you know? When the penis is getting all hard, like you're thinking..."
"For God's sake, Prabhu, I know what an erection is," I grumbled. "Get on with it. What happened?"
"Nothing happened,"
he replied, puzzled by my irritation and somewhat chastened.
But from that time only, I never forgot my big, big feeling for her. Now I am making a marriage, and that big, big feeling is getting bigger every day.
I'm not sure that I like where this is going, Prabhu, I muttered.
I am asking you, Lin,
he said, choking on the words. He faced me. Tears bulged and rolled from his eyes into his lap. His voice came in stuttering sobs.
She is too beautiful. I am a very short and small man. Do you think I can make a good and sexy husband?
I told Prabhakar, sitting in his cab and watching him cry, that love makes men big and hate makes them small. I told him that my little friend was one of the biggest men I ever met because there wasn't any hate in him. I said that the better I knew him, the bigger he got, and I tried to tell him how rare that was. And I joked with him and laughed with him until that great smile, as big as a child's biggest wish, returned to his gentle round face. He drove away toward the bachelor party that was waiting for him in the slum and sounded the horn triumphantly until he was out of sight. The night that walked me, long after he left, was lonelier than most. I didn't go back to Leopold. I walked instead along the causeway, past my apartment, and on to Prabhakar's slum at Cuff Parade. I found the place where Tariq and I fought the vicious pack on the night of the wild dogs. There was still a small pile of scrap timber and stones on the spot. I sat there, smoking in the darkness, and watching the slow elegance of the slum dwellers drifting back along the dusty track to the huddle of huts. I smiled. Thinking of Prabhakar's mighty smile always made me smile reflexively, as if I was looking at a happy, healthy baby. Then a vision of Modena's face flowed from the flickering lanterns and vaporous wreaths of smoke, and faded again to nothing before it was fully formed. Music started up inside the slum. A strolling group of young men quickened their pace to jog toward the stirring sound. Prabhakar's bachelor party had begun. He'd invited me, but I couldn't bring myself to go. I sat near enough to hear the happiness, but far enough away not to feel it. For years, I'd told myself that love had made me strong when the prison guards tried to force me to betray the actress and our affair. Somehow, Modena had haunted the truth from me. It wasn't love for her that had kept me silent, and it wasn't a brave heart. It was stubbornness that had given me the strength to bite down. Stiff-necked, bull-headed stubbornness. There was nothing noble in it, and for all my contempt for the cowardice of bullies, hadn't I become a bully when I was desperate enough? When the dragon claws of heroin sickness dug into my back, I became a small man, a tiny man. I became so small that I had to use a gun. I had to point a gun at people, many of them women, to get money. To get money. How was I different in that, to Maurizio bullying women to get money? And if they'd shot me during one of those hold-ups, if the cops had gunned me down as I'd wanted and expected at the time, my death would have aroused and deserved as little pity as that of the crazed Italian. I stood up and stretched, looking around me and thinking of the dogs and the fight and the bravery of the little boy, Tariq. When I started back toward the city, I heard a sudden eruption of happy laughter from many voices at Prabhakar's party, followed by a cloudburst rattle of applause. And the music dwindled with the distance, until it was as faint and diminishable as any moment of truth. Walking through the night, alone with the city for hours, I loved her with my wandering, just as I'd done when I lived in the slum. Near dawn, I bought a newspaper, found a cafe, and ate a big breakfast, lingering over a second and then a third pot of chai. There was an article on page 3 of the paper, describing the miraculous gifts of the Blue Sisters, as Rashid's widow and her sister had become known. It was a syndicated article, written by Kavita Singh, and published across the country. In it, she gave a brief history of their story, and then related several first-hand accounts of miraculous cures that had been attributed to the mystical powers the girls exercised. One woman claimed to have been cured of tuberculosis. Another insisted that her hearing had been fully restored. And an elderly man declared that his withered lungs were strong and healthy again after he merely touched a hem of their sky-blue garment. Kavita explained that the name Blue Sisters wasn't their choice. They wore blue always because they woke from their comas with a shared dream about floating in the sky, and their devotees had settled on the name. The article concluded with Kavita's own account of a meeting with the girls, and her conviction that they were, beyond any doubt, special, perhaps even supernatural, beings. I paid the bill and borrowed a pen from the cashier to circle the article with several lines. As the streets unwound the tangled morning coil of sound, colour and commotion, I took a cab and jounced through reckless traffic to the Arthur Road prison. After a wait of 3 hours, I made my way into the visiting area. It was a single room divided down the centre by two walls of cyclone wire that were separated by an empty space of about 2 metres. On one side were the visitors, squeezed together and holding their places by clinging to the wire. Across the gap and behind the other wire fence were the prisoners, crushed together and also grasping at the wire to steady themselves. There were about 20 prisoners. 40 of us crowded into an equal space on the visitors' side. Every man, woman and child in the divided room was shouting. There were so many languages. I recognised 6 of them and stopped counting as a door opened on the prisoners' side. Anand entered, pushing his way through to the wire.
"Anand! Anand! Here!" I shouted.
His eyes found me, and he smiled in greeting.
"Lin Baba, so good to see you," he shouted back at me.
"You look good, man,"
I called out. He did look well. I knew how hard it was to look well in that place. I knew what an effort he'd put into it. Cleaning body lice from his clothes every day and washing in the worm-infested water.
"You look real good."
"Array, you look very fine, Lin."
I didn't look fine. I knew that. I looked worried and guilty and tired.
"I'm a bit tired. My friend Vikram, you remember him? He got married yesterday. The day before yesterday, actually. I've been walking all night."
"How is Kasim Ali? Is he well?"
"He's well," I replied, reddening a little with shame that I didn't see the good and noble headman as often as I used to when I'd lived in the slum. "Look! Look at this newspaper. There's an article in it about the sisters. It mentions you. We can use this to help you. We can build up some sympathy for you before your case comes to court."
His long, lean, handsome face darkened in a frown that drew his brows together and pressed his lips into a tight, defiant crease.
"You must not do this, Lin," he shouted back at me. "That journalist, that Kavita Singh, she was here. I send her away. If she comes again, I will send her away again. I do not want any help, and I will not allow any help. I want to have the punishment for what I did to Rashid."
"But you don't understand," I insisted. "The girls are famous now. People think they're holy. People think they can work miracles. There's thousands of devotees coming to the Jhopad party every week. When people know you are trying to help them, they'll feel sympathy for you. You'll get half the time or even less."
I was shouting myself hoarse, trying to be heard above or within the clamouring din.
It was so hot in the crush of bodies that my shirt was already soaked and clung to my skin. Had I heard him correctly? It seemed impossible that he would reject any help that might reduce his sentence. Without that help, he was sure to serve a minimum of 15 years. 15 years in this hell, I thought, staring through the wire at his frowning face. How could he refuse our help?
Lin, no, he cried out, louder than before. I did that thing to Rashid. I knew what I was doing. I knew what would happen. I sat with him for a long time before I did it. I made a choice. I must have the punishment.
But I have to help you. I have to try.
No, Lin, please. If you take this punishment away, then there will be no meaning for what I did. There will be no honor. Not for me, not for them. Can't you see it? I have earned this punishment. I have become my fate. I am begging you, as a friend, please do not let them write anything more about me. Write about the ladies, the sisters, yes. But let me have the peace of my fate. Do you promise me? Lin Baba, do you swear it?
My fingers clutched at the diamonds of the wire fence. I felt the cold, rusty metal bite at the bones within my hands. The noise in that wooden room was like a wild rainstorm on the ragged rooftops of the slum. Beseeching, entreating, adoring, yearning, crying, screaming, and laughing. The hysterical choruses shouted from cage to cage.
Swear it to me, Lin, he said,
the distress reaching out to me desperately from his pleading eyes.
Okay, okay, I answered him,
struggling to let the words escape from the little prison of my throat.
Swear it to me. All right, I swear it. For God's sake, I swear. I won't try to help you.
His face relaxed, and the smile returned, burning my eyes with the beauty of it.
Thank you, Lin Baba,
he shouted back happily.
Please don't be thinking I am ungrateful. But I don't want you to come back here again. I don't want you to visit me. You can put some money for me sometimes, if you think of it, but please don't come back again. This is my life now. This is my life. It will be hard for me if you come back here. I will think about things. I thank you very much, Lin. And I wish a full happiness for you.
His hands released their hold on the wire fence. He held them together in a praying gesture of blessing, bowing his head slightly, so that I lost contact with his eyes. Without that strong grip on the fence, he was at the mercy of the crowd of prisoners, and in seconds he fell back, vanishing into the bubbling wave of faces and hands at the wire. A door at the back of the room opened behind the prisoners, and I watched Anand slip through into the hot yellow light of day, with his head high and his thin shoulders bravely squared. I stepped out into the street outside the prison. My hair was wet with sweat, and my clothes were soaked. I squinted in the sunlight and stared at the busy street, trying to force myself into its rhythm and rush, trying not to think about Anand in the long room with the overseers, with Big Rahul, with the hunger and the beatings and the filthy swarming pests. Later that night, I would be with Prabhakar and Johnny Sagar, Anand's friends, while they celebrated the double wedding. Later that night, Anand would be crammed into a writhing, lice-crawling sleep with 200 other men on a stone floor. And that would go on and on for 15 years. I took a cab to my apartment and stood under a hot shower, scorching the slither and itch of memory from my skin. Later, I phoned Chandra Mehta to make the final arrangements for the dancers I'd hired to perform at Prabhakar's wedding. Then I phoned Kavita Singh,
and told her that Anand wanted us to pull out of the campaign. She was relieved, I think. Her kind heart had fretted for him, and she'd feared from the first that the campaign would fail and then crush him with the weight of fallen hope. She was also glad that he'd given his blessing to her stories about the Blue Sisters. The girls fascinated her, and she'd arranged for a documentary filmmaker to visit them in the slum. She wanted to talk about the project, and I heard the sparkling enthusiasm in her voice, but I cut her off, promising to call again. I went out to my little balcony and let the sound and the smell of the city settle on the skin of my bare chest. In a courtyard below, I saw three young men rehearsing the moves and steps of a dance routine they'd copied from a Bollywood film. They laughed helplessly when they messed up the moves of the party piece, and then gave a cheer when they finally danced through one whole routine without error. In another yard, some women were squatting together, washing dishes with small anemones of coir rope and a long bar of coral-coloured soap. Their conversation came to me in laughing gasps and shrieks as they scandalised one another with gossip and sardonic commentaries on the peculiar habits of their neighbours' husbands. Then I looked up to see an elderly man sitting in a window opposite me. My eyes met his, and I smiled. He'd been watching me, as I'd watched the others below. He wagged his head from side to side and smiled back at me with a happy grin. And it was all right. I dressed and went down to the street. I made the rounds of the black market currency collection centres and checked in at Abdul Ghani's passport factory and inspected the gold smuggling ring I'd restructured in Kader's name. In 3 hours, I committed 30 crimes or more. And I smiled when people smiled at me. When it was necessary, I gave men enough bad head, as gangsters call it, to make them draw back and lower their eyes in fear. I walked the Gunda walk, and in three languages I talked the talk. I looked good. I did my job. I made money, and I was still free. But in the black room, deep in my mind, another image added itself to the secret gallery. An image of Anand, holding the palms of his hands together as his radiant smile became a blessing and a prayer. Everything you ever sense, in touch or taste or sight or even thought, has an effect on you that's greater than zero. Some things, like the background sound of a bird chirping as it passes your house in the evening, or a flower glimpsed out of the corner of an eye, have such an infinitesimally small effect that you can't detect them. Some things, like triumph and heartbreak, and some images, like the image of yourself reflected in the eyes of a man you've just stabbed, attach themselves to the secret gallery, and they change your life forever. That last image of Anand, the last time I ever saw him, had that effect on me. It wasn't compassion for him that I felt so deeply, although I did pity him as only a chained man could. It wasn't shame, although I was truly ashamed that I hadn't listened when he'd first tried to tell me about Rashid. It was something else, something so strange that it took me years to fully comprehend. It was envy that nailed the image to my mind. I envied Anand as he turned and walked with his back straight and his head high into the long suffering years. I envied his peace and his courage, and his perfect understanding of himself. Kader Bhai once said that if we envy someone for all the right reasons, we're halfway to wisdom. I hope he wasn't right about that. I hope good envy takes you further than that. Because a lifetime has passed since that day at the wire, and I still envy Anand's calm communion with fate, and I long for it with all my flawed and striving heart. Chapter 29. Eyes curved like the sword of Perseus, like the wings of hawks in flight, like the rolled lips of seashells, like eucalyptus leaves in summer.
Indian eyes, dancer's eyes, the most beautiful eyes in the world, stared with honest, unbeguiling concentration into mirrors held for them by their servants. The dancers I'd hired to perform at the wedding ceremonies for Johnny and Prabhakar were already in costume beneath the modest covering of their shawls. In a chai shop near the entrance to the slum, emptied of customers for the purpose, they made the final adjustments to their hair and makeup, professionally swift amid excited chattering. A cotton sheet strung across the doorway was just sheer enough in the golden lamplight to reveal thrillingly indistinct shadows, inflaming fierce desires in many of those who crowded outside, where I stood guard and kept the curious at bay. At last they were ready, and I threw the cotton screen back. The 10 dancers from Film City's chorus lines emerged. They wore traditional tight choli blouses and wraparound saris. The costumes were lemon yellow, ruby, peacock blue, emerald, sunset pink, gold, royal purple, silver, cream, and tangerine. Their jewels, hair clusters, plait tassels, earrings, nose rings, necklaces, midriff chains, bangles, and anklets, struck such sparks of light from lanterns and electric bulbs that people blinked and flinched to look at them. Every heavy anklet carried hundreds of tiny bells, and as the dancers began their slow, swaying walk through the hushed and adoring slum, the sizzling clash of those silver bells was the only sound that marked their steps. Then they began to sing. Aja Sajan, Aja, Aja Sajan, Aja. Come to me, my lover, come to me. Come to me, my lover, come to me. The crowds that preceded and surrounded them roared their approval. A platoon of small boys scrambled along the rough path ahead of the girls, removing stones or twigs and sweeping the way clear with palm leaf brooms. Other young men walked beside the dancers, cooling them with large pear-shaped fans of fine woven cane. Further ahead along the path, the band of musicians I'd hired with the dancers approached the wedding stage silently in their red and white uniforms. Prabhakar and Parvati sat to one side, and Johnny Sagar sat with Sita on the other side. Prabhakar's parents, Kishan and Rukmabai, had travelled from Sunda for the event. They planned to spend a full month in the city, staying in a slum hut beside Prabhakar's own. They sat at the front of the stage with Kumar and Nandita Patak. A huge painting of a lotus flower filled the space behind them, and coloured lights formed glowing vines overhead. When the dancers slowly entered the space, singing love, they stopped as one and stamped their feet. They twirled in place, turning clockwise in perfect unison. Their arms moved with the grace of a swan's neck. Their hands and fingers rolled and swirled like silk scarves sailing the wind. Then, suddenly, they stamped their feet 3 times, and the musicians struck up a wild, enravishing rendition of that month's most popular movie song. And with the cheering in every throat around them, the girls danced into a million dreams. Not a few of those dreams were my own. I'd hired the girls and the musicians, not knowing what kind of show they'd planned to put on for Prabhakar's wedding. Chandra Mehta had recommended them to me, and he'd assured me that they always devised their own program. That first black market money deal Mehta had asked me to transact, the 10,000 American dollars he'd wanted, had borne black fruit. Through him, I'd met others in the film world who wanted gold, dollars, and documents. In the previous few months, my visits to the film studios had grown more frequent, and the profit for Kadarbai accumulated steadily. There was a certain reciprocal cachet in the connection. The filmy types, as they were known in Bollywood, found it exhilarating to be associated, at a safe distance, with the notorious Mafia Don. And the Khan himself wasn't indifferent to the glamour that laminated the movie world. When I approached Chandra Mehta for help in organising the dancers, 2 weeks before Prabhakar's wedding, he'd assumed that the Prabhakar in question was an important gunda working for Kadarbai. He put time and special care into the arrangements, selecting each girl from personal knowledge of her skills, and teaming them with a band of the best studio musicians. The show, when we finally saw it, would have satisfied the manager of the raunchiest nightclub in the city. The band played a long top 10 of the season's most popular songs. The girls sang and danced to every one of them, giving seductive and erotic emphasis to the subtext of each phrase. Some of the thousands of neighbours and guests at the slum wedding were pleasantly scandalised, but most were delighted by the wickedness. Prabhakar and Johnny first among them. And I, seeing for the first time how lubricious the uncensored versions of the dances were, gained a new appreciation of the subtler gestures I'd seen so often in the Hindi films. I gave Johnny Sagar $5,000 American as a wedding present. It was enough money for him to buy the little hut that he wanted in the Navy Nagar slum, near the spot where he'd been conceived. The Nagar was a legal slum, and purchasing the hut there meant the end of eviction fears. He would have a secure home from which to continue his work as unofficial accountant and tax consultant to the many hundreds of workers and small businesses in the surrounding slums. My present to Prabhakar was the deed to his taxi. The owner of the small fleet of taxis sold the deed to me in a vicious bout of bare tooth and knuckle haggling. I paid too much for the vehicle and its license, but the money meant nothing to me. It was black money, and black money runs through the fingers faster than legal hard-earned money. If we can't respect the way we earn it, money has no value. If we can't use it to make life better for our families and loved ones, money has no purpose. Nevertheless, out of respect for the formalities of tradition, I damned the taxi fleet owner at the conclusion of our deal with that most polite and hideous of Indian business curses. May you have 10 daughters, and may they all marry well. A string of dowry commitments sure to exhaust all but the sturdiest fortunes. Prabhakar was so pleased and excited with the gift that the gravity he'd assumed in the role of the sober groom exploded in a whooping cheer. He leapt to his feet and danced a few pumps of his hip-thrusting, sexy dance before the solemnity of the occasion overwhelmed him once more, and he sat down with his bride. I joined the thick, gyrating jungle of men in the front of the stage and danced until my thin shirt clung to me like seaweed in a shallow wave. Returning to my apartment that night, I smiled to think how different Vikram's wedding had been. 2 days before Prabhakar and Johnny wed their sister brides, Vikram was married to Letty. Against the passionate and occasionally violent opposition of his family, Vikram had opted for a registry office ceremony. He'd responded to the tears and pleading of his loved ones with one formulaic phrase.
"This is the modern India, yeah?"
Few of his family members could bring themselves to face the agony of that public repudiation of the ancient, gorgeously elaborate Hindu wedding they'd long planned for him. In the end, it was only his sister and his mother who joined the little circle of Letty's friends and watched as the bride and groom promised to love and honour one another for the rest of their days. There was no music, no colour, and no dancing. Letty wore a burnt gold suit with a broad gold straw hat bearing organdy roses. Vikram wore a 3/4-length black coat, a black-and-white brocade vest, black gaucho pants with silver piping, and his beloved hat. The ceremony was over in minutes, and then Vikram and I half-carried his grief-stricken mother to her waiting car. On the day after their wedding, I drove Vikram and Letty to the airport. Their plan was to repeat the ceremony in London with Letty's family. While Letty phoned her mother to confirm their arrival time, Vikram seized the opportunity for a heart-to-heart with me.
"Thanks for the work you did on my passport, man," he grinned. "That fucking drug conviction in Denmark, it's only a little thing, but it could have given me a big headache, yeah?"
"No problem."
"And the dollars, that was a fucking good rate you got for us. I know you did a special deal on that, yeah? And I'll return the favor somehow when we get back."
"It's cool.
You know, Lin, you really ought to settle down, man. I don't mean to jinx up your scene or anything. I'm only saying it as a friend. As a friend who loves you like a brother. You're heading for a big fall, man. I got a bad feeling.
I think you should settle down, like.
Settle down?
Yeah, man. That's the whole point of it, yeah?
The whole point of what?
That's what the whole fucking game is all about. You're a man. That's what a man has to do. I don't mean to get into your personal shit, but it's kind of sad that you don't know that already.
I laughed, but he held the serious frown.
Lynn, a man has to find a good woman. And when he finds her, he has to win her love. Then he has to earn her respect. Then he has to cherish her trust. And then he has to, like, go on doing that for as long as they live, until they both die. That's what it's all about. That's the most important thing in the world. That's what a man is, yeah? A man is truly a man when he wins the love of a good woman, earns her respect, and keeps her trust. Until you can do that, you're not a man.
Tell that to Didier.
No, man, you're not getting it. It's just the same for Didier, but with him it's a good guy he has to find and love. It's the same for all of us. What I'm trying to tell you is that you found a good woman. You found her already. Carla is a good woman, man. And you earned her fucking respect. She told me a couple of times, man, about the cholera and all that in the Jopat party. You knocked her out with all that Red Cross shit, man. She respects you. But you don't cherish her trust. You don't trust her, Lynn, because you don't trust yourself. And I'm afraid for you, man. Without a good woman, a man like you, men like you and me, we are just asking for trouble, yeah?
Letty approached us. The grim purpose dimmed in his eyes, washed away by the look of love he turned on her.
"They're calling our flight, Lynn, me darling," she said.
Her smile was sadder than I'd expected, and wounding somehow because of it.
"We better go. Here, I want you to have this, as a present from both of us."
She handed me a folded strip of black cloth, about a metre long and a handspan wide. When I opened it out, I found a small card in the centre.
"It's the blindfold," she said. "You know, from the train, on the roof, the day Vikram proposed. We want you to have it, as a souvenir, you know. And on the card, that's Carla's address. She wrote to us. She's still in Goa, but in a different part. Just, you know, if you're interested. Goodbye, darling. Take care."
I watched them leave, happy for them, but too busy with Kada's work and the preparations for Prabhakar's wedding to give much thought to Vikram's advice. Then the visit to Anand, the last visit, had pushed Vikram's voice even deeper into the choir of competing speeches, warnings and opinions. But as I sat alone in my apartment on the night of Prabhakar's wedding and took the note and the black strip of the blindfold from my pocket, I remembered every word he'd said to me. I sipped at a drink and smoked cigarettes in a silence so profound that I could hear the susurrus of the blindfold's soft fabric rustle and slip between my fingers. The seductive, bell-bejeweled dancers had been escorted to their bus and paid a respectful bonus. Prabhakar and Johnny had led their brides away to taxis that waited to take them to a simple but comfortable hotel on the outskirts of the city. For 2 nights, they would know the joys of private love before their public loves in the crowded slums resumed. Vikram and Letty were already in London, preparing to repeat the vows that meant everything to my cowboy-obsessed friend. And I was sitting in the armchair, fully dressed and alone, not trusting her, as Vikram said, because I didn't trust myself. Then at last, when I drifted to sleep, the note and the strip of blindfold slipped from my fingers. And for 3 weeks after that night, I tried to lose the loneliness that their 3 happy marriages had pulled from my heart, by taking every job I was offered, and cutting every deal I could devise. I flew one passport run to Kinshasa, staying, as instructed, at the La Pierre Hotel. It was a nearly squalid, three-story building in a laneway parallel to Kinshasa's long main street. The mattress was clean, but the floor and the walls seemed to be made from recycled coffin wood. The grave-like smell was overpowering, and a sweating damp filled my mouth with gloomy, unidentifiable tastes. I chain-smoked gitanes and gargled Belgian whiskey to kill them. Rat-catchers patrolled the corridors, dragging conspicuous Hessian sacks that bulged with writhing fat animals. Cockroach colonies had claimed the drawers of the dresser, so I hung my clothing and toiletries and other personal items from hooks and thick, crooked nails, conveniently hammered into every surface that would endure them. On my first night, I was ripped from a light sleep by gunshots in the corridor beyond my door. I heard a crumpling thump, as of a body falling, and then shuffling footsteps pulling something heavy, backwards, along the bare wooden floor of the hallway. I clamped a fist around my knife and opened the door. Men were standing at three other doors in the corridor, drawn as I was by the sounds. They were all Europeans. Two of them held pistols in their hands, and one held a knife similar to my own. We all looked at one another, and then at the trail of blood that smeared its way down the corridor out of sight. As if in response to a secret signal, we all closed our doors again without a word. When I followed the Kinshasa run with a mission to Mauritius, my hotel on the island nation provided a welcome and agreeable contrast. It was called the Mandarin, and it was in Curepipe. The original structure was built as a small-scale reproduction of a Scottish castle. The turreted resemblance was clear enough on the winding approach through a neat English garden. Inside the building, however, the guest entered a kingdom of Chinese baroque, designed by the Chinese family who were the new owners of the hotel. I sat beneath huge fire-breathing dragons and ate Chinese broccoli with snow peas, garlic spinach, fried bean curd, and mushrooms in black bean sauce by the light of paper lanterns, while the windows gave a view of castellated battlements, Gothic arches, and rose-studded topiary. My contacts, two Indians from Bombay who lived in Mauritius, arrived in a yellow BMW, as had been arranged. I got into the back of the car and had barely spoken a greeting when they took off at such tire-torching speed that I was hurled backwards into a corner of the seat. We screamed along back roads at four times the speed limit for 15 knuckle-whitening minutes, and then they pulled into a silent, deserted grove. The overheated car cooled down with little clinks and clunks of sound. There was a strong smell of rum on both men.
"Okay, let's have the books,"
one of the two contacts said, leaning around from the driver's seat.
"I haven't got them," I snarled at him through clenched teeth.
The contacts looked at one another and then back at me. The driver raised his mercury lens glasses, revealing eyes that looked as though he kept them in a glass of brown vinegar beside his bed at night.
"You don't got the books?"
"No, I was trying to tell you that on the way here, wherever the fuck we are. But you kept saying, keep cool, and not listening to me. Well, are we cool enough now, huh?"
"I'm not cool, man," the passenger said.
I saw myself in the lenses of his glasses. I didn't look happy.
"You idiots," I growled, switching to Hindi. "You nearly killed us all for nothing. Driving like a speed freak asshole Bombay taxi driver with the cops up his ass. The passports are back at the sister fucking hotel. I stashed them because I wanted to be sure of you two motherfuckers first. Now the only thing I'm sure of is that you guys haven't got the brains of two fleas on a pariah dog's balls."
The passenger lifted his glasses, and they both smiled as widely as their hangovers would allow.
"Where the fuck did you learn to speak Hindi like that?" the driver asked. "It's fucking great, yeah? You're speaking like a regular Bombay sister fucker. It's fantastic, yeah?"
Damned impressive, man, his friend added, wagging his head admiringly.
Let me see the money, I snapped.
They laughed,